Hey, folks, thanks for tuning back in to the CBSSports.com College Football Podcast. I am Chip Patterson, and as always, for this Heisman Cast edition of the podcast, I am pleased to welcome Mr. Chris Houston, Heisman Pundit, HeismanPundit.com, and CBSSports.com Heisman Expert. Chris, the ballots went out this week, right, for Heisman voting?
Yes, they are. I haven't actually received my ballot in the mail yet. You know, the ballot really is, all it really is email instructions on how to vote online. So it's not like the old days when you filled it out and sent it back via snail mail. It's merely just an information packet.
Do you expect that the fact that ballots or the instruction packet is mailed this week, you know, you wrote about this a little bit in your Heisman notes, but it's interesting because people that are trying to put Johnny Manziel, you know, right there in the Heisman conversation, you know, it's all very good timing because you told me on this very, when we had a Heisman cast, you know, if he was going to go to New York, he needed to beat Alabama and Tuscaloosa. So Chris, you see him in New York now that, Johnny Manziel pulled the shocker?
He better get his tux ready. I think he's going. Just like we talked about, he had to beat Alabama. And, you know, we knew that if A&M was going to beat Alabama, it would require the kind of game he had. It wasn't going to happen with you know, Kristen Michael going off or you know, whatever other scenario you could envision. We knew it was going to be because Johnny Manziel was going to have a trademark game passing and running, and that's what he did. And when you make that kind of splash as a freshman beating the number one team, it's going to really resonate across the country, and I think it did to a large extent now. That all being said, I'm a little surprised. And one of the things I do in covering the Heisman race is I try to really put on my old PR cap, which I used to do a lot of PR back in the day. And, of course, I worked for USC and ran some Heisman campaigns. But part of running an effective campaign is knowing what people are thinking, knowing what the buzz is, what people are talking about, and trying to find the little data points out there to see what some of the movers and shakers are talking about. And I'm actually a little bit surprised that his win or his performance in the win didn't create as much buzz as I thought it would. I didn't see as much Twitter talk as I thought I would, and I didn't see as much talk in the general media as I thought I would. There is a lot, for sure. I thought it would be potentially overwhelming. To me, it doesn't compare to what Ndamukong Suh did in for Nebraska on that final weekend against Texas a few years ago, and it doesn't really compared to what Tyrann Mathieu did with those punt returns. It feels like it's close to that, but not quite as strong. And so it kind of leads me to believe that while he's definitely going to New York, I'm not sure it's going to be enough to carry him through to a win.
Do you think at all, because I was wondering, and I'm glad you mentioned PR. That was actually my next move. Texas A&M has a policy of not allowing the freshmen to meet with the media, to speak with the media. They've maintained that policy all throughout this, you know, incredible redshirt freshman season for Manziel. And I wonder if, you know, maybe not intentionally, but maybe even subconsciously, the fact that he is not made available and that reporters don't get their chance to hear what he has to say leads to a little less hype. If he could just give, you know, the game columnist, if he was able to give them a quote that they could use for their column, it'd be, I wonder, not necessarily if it's hurting him, but it's limiting the amount of hype that he could be able to get.
I agree 100%. I think it's a real big factor, and you're absolutely dead on with that, Chip, because you're looking at a situation where, you know, there is regionalism in the Heisman vote. There are people who vote for people based on who they know and who they see all the time, and there, you know, the kind of the buzz comes around, or I should say, the information kind of moves through the media world pretty quickly. You know, when you have these big games, say this Saturday, Oregon and Stanford is the big game of the week, and all these national writers converge upon these games, and they start talking to each other, and they start saying, "Hey, this, how is this guy when you talk to him? Is he good?" And they, you know, there's sort of a little bit of a water cooler thing, and they start talking about how this guy's a good interview, or how this guy, you know, is really articulate, or this guy's got a, you know, good story, and they haven't been able to do that with Johnny Manziel yet, and I think it's highly counterproductive. Especially in the case of, this is a guy who is you know, he's going to be going to New York. Are they going to not let him go to New York and speak to the media? Because, that's what he's going to have to do. It's just a little bit odd at this point, considering he is a redshirt freshman. He's been at A&M for, into his second fall here. So obviously he has, a little bit of a checkered past. Maybe they're worried about him saying something silly, but I still think it's very counterproductive, and it would definitely improve his chances and improve his PR if he was getting out there a little bit, not a lot, but just get out there a little bit, do a few choice TV hits, maybe a few radios, and suddenly people learn a little bit about the guy underneath the football helmet.
Yeah, I understand, especially the preseason media availability, and every team has their own policy. I understand for true freshmen, but like you just said, the guy's been in the program for a year. You would think that the sports information department would feel comfortable sort of letting him go a little bit. But how about that? Do you think that it would be worth making an exception to a policy that's been in place? I don't know how long it's been in place, but what's your opinion on that?
Well, I'm pretty sure the Texas A&M Sports Information Department would, if it was up to them, would love to have Johnny Manziel speak to the media. I'm almost certain this is a Kevin Sumlin policy. I myself tried to get Johnny on an interview earlier in the year, and I was told it was the coach's policy. So I'm pretty sure that, SIDs would rather be hawking him to the media left and right, I'm sure, but this appears to be a situation where Coach Sumlin wants to, control the hype around certain players, and maybe he feels that Manziel will lose focus. But, personally, they've got Sam Houston State in Missouri left. I'm not sure at this point how you're going to distract him from having a good, finishing out the season strong. This seems like it'd be a perfect beat coming off of Alabama and coming into basically what amounts to a bye week to let this guy talk, but it's not happening.
You wrote in your notes talking about freshmen and the Heisman, which is, of course, the one thing they are at an extreme disadvantage, particularly coming into the season. You're not going to know. A lot of times we've talked about sort of the Heisman resume year. This will certainly help Manziel in the future, but you pointed out that, what is it, Walker, Herschel Walker, Michael Vick, Adrian Peterson, only freshmen to finish top four, top three?
Top three.
Yeah. And do you think that there are enough qualities where Manziel could also finish in that top three, or do you think going to New York is sort of his ceiling?
No, I think he's sorry, I got a little bit of a bug in my throat here, but I think he's definitely a strong candidate to finish the top three, and I think he's got a real good chance to finish second, actually. I think there just aren't enough people out there right now who can wrap their head around the idea that Johnny Manziel, after 78 years, is going to be the freshman to do it. He did perform incredibly against Alabama, and his numbers are incredible. It's just, you look at the Heisman voters out there, and they're going to say, well, I've got three more years to vote for Johnny Manziel, but this is the only chance I've got to vote Colin Klein for the Heisman, given the year he's had and what he's done with Kansas State. And that's going to be the rationale a lot of people will take. And it's going to be the rationale even when you look at the ballots across the country, because it's not just about who's going to be number one on so many ballots. It's who's going to appear on a lot of ballots. And I think Colin Klein's strength is going to be that he's going to appear on a lot of ballots. Whereas if you look on the West Coast, you might see people like Marcus Mariota and Kenyon Barner and Marquise Lee eat into what Johnny Manziel would normally be on a ballot, whereas Colin Klein will get a lot of second and third, and he'll appear, I think, across the country. He's kind of a great compromise candidate for a lot of people who may not have him number one, but they will definitely have him on a ballot.
Right, and this is, I was excited because we talked at the before the season, one of the things that made Geno Smith such an attractive candidate is because he was at a mid-Atlantic school playing a lot of his games in the Southwest with the Big 12. This is the flip of that, a Big 12 region school playing most of all the competition in the Southeast. And so that when we were thinking about Heisman, that's what went off for me is like you said, he's not going to be number one on a lot of ballots, but he is going to be on a ton of ballots just with the regional voting.
Yeah, you know, Manziel is the SEC candidate at this point. I think McCarron will drop off on a lot of ballots, but I think Colin Klein will still win the Southwest. But I still think Colin Klein will do well in the Southeast as well, or the SEC area. He's going to do well in the Northeast, and he's going to do well in the Midwest. He's sort of an all things, all people candidate in that regard. And he's sort of the guy that, there's nothing unacceptable to people about Colin Klein. No one's bad-mouthing him and saying that he doesn't deserve the Heisman. They may like somebody better, but Colin Klein is not somebody that they are recoiling from. But there might be people who say, well, I'm not going to put a freshman on the top ballot just because he beat Alabama, or I'm not going to put this Oregon guy on there because he's a part of the system, or I'm not going to put Marquise Lee on there because, you know, his team is disappointing. There's really nothing that people find objectionable to Colin Klein, right now, and that's why I think he's going to be on a lot of ballots.
You just mentioned Marquise Lee. Lee did check in on defense, and one of your sort of rules of thumb has always been for a wide receiver, you need to be able to do more than that. If Marquise Lee plays more defense, does he need to do any? Is it running back a kick? If he's contributing in all three phases of the game, does he have a chance to be able to stage a late season comeback? Because with UCLA ahead, they could win the South, and then of course you've got a possible rematch against Oregon. It seems to me like if Marquise Lee is going to do it, he's going to have the opportunities to create big plays on very, very big stages.
Yeah, you can really easily create the scenario in which Marquise Lee makes a really strong run here at the end, because like you said, you got the UCLA game coming up, which is for the Pac-12 South. If he does some special things in there, let's just assume for argument's sake that Marquise Lee on the receiving end of the equation does what he always does, has 10 catches for 150 yards in the remaining three games. If he accentuates those receiving totals by, running a reverse on one of them in one of the games and returning a kick for a touchdown, or playing a little bit of defense and maybe notching a couple tackles or making a deflection, those types of things could create a late surge toward him, especially when you consider that he will have gone up against Notre Dame in the second week of that 3-week run, and then potentially against Oregon. Depends on what USC does against Oregon. It would require, I think, for him to lead USC to a win over Oregon, for him to actually have a chance to win the Heisman. But I do think that if USC beats Notre Dame and Marquise Lee has a remarkable game in that game, I think then he's definitely heading to New York, and I think he has a chance to finish in the top three if that happens.
Right, I completely forgot about that. I don't know how I forgot about that Notre Dame game. It is the biggest game for Notre Dame and USC, obviously, after they get past UCLA for the South. What about where's Teo fall in all this? Because he's starting to, as far as the buzz goes, and you talked about sort of monitoring what people are talking about, it seems as though the last maybe week and a half, 2 weeks, he's still been playing very well. He had the interception. Is he still buzzing as the defensive candidate that some people almost want to force into the finalist group?
Well, I think reality is starting to set in for what usually happens when a defensive player competes for the Heisman. And in the most recent years, it hasn't been the case that that they peaked early. It's been the case that with Sue and with Matthew, they've peaked at the very, very end, before there was a chance for any kind of counter argument to kind of take sway. Sue in the Big 12 title game and Matthew in the SEC title game both had remarkable plays and remarkable games, and that was with voters looking having to vote the next day and having those very fresh in their mind. As far as Teo, in the meantime, he had his kind of his peak in the middle of the season. In the meantime, all these other offensive players have emerged: Marquise Lee, Johnny Manziel, Kenyon Barner. People are talking about other players right now. And Teo's got to really do something special against USC in order to get to New York. I think he's got to make some highlight reel plays, and he's got to lead Notre Dame to that win and get to the, you know, get to the undefeated season, because you know, the next week he's not playing, and meanwhile Colin Klein is playing, Marquise Lee is potentially playing, and Oregon, of course, Kenyon Barner and Marcus Mariota are definitely playing, or so we think.
Ohio State's not playing, but it's looking like they will have a shot at that undefeated season. Where does Braxton Miller fall in all this?
Well, I don't think he can win, but he definitely has a chance to get to New York. It depends on how the other candidates wind up. He still picks up some decent amount of support in my Heisman straw poll. The problem is that he and Tao are both kind of jockeying for support in the Midwest region. So I think Tao is going to get some support out west because he's a Hawaii guy. But Miller, I think his problem is he just hasn't played in any games that are really relevant to the season this year. The Big Ten has sort of been the conference that is kind of on the other side of the, you know, other side of the country, doing what they're doing and not really taking part in the conversation with the, you know, the national polls and all that. So he's going to have the Michigan game and not get to play in the Big Ten title game. So he's got a chance to get to New York, but I do think that this is one of those situations where he's setting himself up for, you know, to be the front runner for next year.
There's still, obviously, we've mentioned a couple of scenarios down the stretch where, you know, a Heisman-type impact can be made. But now that the voting has begun, just how are you thinking that we're going to look back and remember this Heisman race? Because, you know, I feel as though each year there's a couple of things that you're always going to stick out. Like, I thought that in 2010... Luck came on really strong near the end. You sort of thought of Luck as the go-to guy last season. Robert Griffin coming on sort of as the surprise. And obviously Trent Richardson was always there, but for some reason to me never, you know, jumped up and owned it right there near the end. How do you imagine you're going to look back on this year's Heisman race sort of from the preseason hype at least to where we are now?
I think we're going to look back on this Heisman race and see a Heisman race that does what the Heisman race usually does, which is it sort of mirrors the national title race. It sort of is a alter ego to what's going on the team level. It shows up in what's going on at the player level. You're looking at a situation where you have two schools involved, Oregon and Kansas State, who have never won a Heisman. And they've never won a national title either. And they're both in the mix for both of those awards here at the very end. You've got a player, Johnny Manziel, a freshman's never won the Heisman. And if it's going to happen, this is one of those situations where if it's going to happen, it might happen here. Otherwise, it may never happen because you're looking at the scenario that was created for this to happen is very rare. And it required all these, you know, all these sort of chips to fall in a certain way, and now he's in a position to possibly do it. You've got Marquise Lee, who is has a chance to pull off a rare feat of, you know, winning the Heisman as a wide receiver, which has only happened twice in the modern era. So you've got all these kind of upstart, interesting candidates, Manti Te'o, defensive candidate, who are kind of representing kind of the convoluted nature of college football in 2012. You look at the top three teams in the country right now, it's Oregon, Kansas State, and Notre Dame, and no one could have predicted that at the beginning of the year, just like no one could have predicted that people like Matt Barkley and Monty Ball and Denard Robinson and Landry Jones would be not even within, you know, throwing range of the Heisman at this point. So it's an upstart season for upstart teams and upstart Heisman candidates. It's a really interesting season, and I really think it's why college football is so great, because you can never count on the tried and true to always happen. There's always some kind of new wrinkle taking place, and I think these candidates really exemplify kind of the direction the sport is going.
Yes, absolutely. I was going to say that this is a perfect example of how little we know And hopefully just, I mean, it's not going to change it because everybody, you know, the embrace debate movement. And like you said, college football is all about somebody thinking that they or their team is getting screwed. But this is, you know, we sat around and debated what's going to happen if the four teams go undefeated. Well, you know what? That didn't happen. And, you know, Geno Smith won the Heisman. This is Denard Robinson's to lose. This is Matt Barkley's to lose. You know, this is this Heisman race to me, and like you said, this football season in general is such a wonderful reminder from the football gods that we don't know anything. And this is I keep looking at 2007 and just being like, you know, that might be where we are headed, because I could see any one of these last three undefeated teams losing down the stretch.
Well, absolutely. I think there's always a potential for chaos, and you know, there's never any sure thing. And that's why when I analyze the Heisman, I'm always very careful to set the parameters for what I'm actually trying to say. And it doesn't always work because people don't actually ever read. You know, I find that people don't really read what you write. They just look at your list. I'm always very careful to say, look, when I make my Heisman watch, this is basically my list of the people who have the most advantage. You know, it's before the season, it's the people with the most advantages heading into the season. In other words, if everything was equal, if everyone had the exact same season production-wise and every team was perfect, these would be the players that would win as a result. And, of course, it's when we get away from those equalities is where we get the real race. And then, so I'm trying to look at these players with their built-in advantages based on these other qualities that they have, because everything else is a variable. Everything else, we can't predict how they will play. We can only predict if they do play well, you know, here's where they'll stand. If they don't play well, here's where they'll stand. And that's how I try to frame the race. And you know, it's only toward the end when I get enough data where I actually make a prediction for the race. And I'm always careful not to say this person has won the race too early, because you just never know.
What is, do you expect, all right, I know you, never mind, that would be asking you to predict the race. Do you think that this will be, if you were to put a guess on what kind of percentage wins this Heisman Trophy, where would you set it?
Yeah. No, I think Colin Klein has an 80% chance to win. Maybe 75% chance to win. Maybe I'd put Manziel at about a 20% chance, and then probably the other guys. Well, maybe it'd be 65, 25, and then the other guys at 5.
Do you think it'll
not
be?
That's not a bad odd for Manziel. That's, you know, 1 in 4 chance. I think Klein's probably got a 2 in 3 chance, and then the other guys probably have a 5% chance.
Do you think it'll be an overwhelming? Obviously, and again, I think that, you know, whether or not Klein is an overwhelming winner probably has a lot to do on whether the Wildcats are able to finish the season undefeated and be in that BCS title game. But I wonder, you know, what don't they do? Isn't there a way to tell how much they won? Like, what were some of the biggest landslides or some of the tighter races in recent history?
Yeah. Well, I one of the things I looked over in my notes today was how the schedule plays out, and one of the reasons why I am a little bit skeptical about Manziel's chances, besides the historical hurdle to overcome, you know, with the freshman factor, is the fact that he plays against Sam Houston State on Saturday, and then he plays against Missouri. Now, Missouri might be of slight interest to some people, but that's being played on the same day as USC Notre Dame and a couple other interesting games going on that day. So I'm not so sure how many people will be paying that close of attention to Texas A&M Missouri. Now, and then we get to the next week. Potentially, we're looking at Pac-12 title game, with Heisman candidates, you know, the SEC title game, which is always a huge, you know, draw for people to watch. And then you've got Kansas State versus Texas, which is Colin Klein's last chance to make his case. You know, by that point, this would now be almost 3 weeks after the Alabama upset. This is what, you know, that Alabama upset has to sort of live on for 3 weeks and overcome the last impressions made by Colin Klein and Marquise Lee and Kenyon Barner and everyone else involved in the race. And I'm a little skeptical whether Manziel can hold on, keep that kind of aura of that magic from that game lasting that long, just because Colin Klein is already the front runner as it is. So if you look at the different regions, you know, this is sort of what I call, maybe it's a turnout election, and maybe they call it in the real world, but I still think if you look across the regions, you're going to see probably Manziel not doing as well on the West Coast, maybe not doing as well in the Midwest as some of the other candidates like Colin Klein. So I think in the end, he's going to probably finish second. I think Colin Klein is going to win it, and I think it's going to be not a landslide. I think it's going to be a somewhat comfortable win, potentially a very close win.
I'm going to have to correct something there, Chris. I think that on December 1st, everybody's going to be watching the ACC championship game when Florida State plays either Duke, Miami, or Georgia Tech in Charlotte. I'm really, really concerned for Colin Klein.
You might be right.
Colin Klein losing all of that national attention when people are watching the Duke Blue Devils in Charlotte.
You never know, because if for some reason things get crazy and Florida State has to win that game to get in there, to get into the BCS title game, maybe people will be watching.
That is true. All right, let's go right here this weekend. In my eyes, obviously the highlight games from a Heisman perspective are USC, UCLA, and Stanford, Oregon. Huge Pac-12 matchups right there, your region. First of all, are you going to USC, UCLA?
Yeah, it looks like I have been tasked to go, and God willing, UCLA approves my credential, I'll be there.
Nice. What is your read on each of those games, just in general?
Well, USC is one of those teams that they can beat any team in the country or lose to any team in the country, maybe except Colorado at any given time, just because they're so poorly coached. But they have so many highly skilled players at the wide receiver spot, and obviously they have Matt Barkley, who's capable of having a great game. But I have to think that the way UCLA has been playing, the momentum they have going in their favor, the improvement they've made under Jim Mora Jr., it could be that UCLA knocks off USC, and that would be horrible for Marquise Lee's Heisman hopes, because that not only would cause the immediate issue of the loss, given his team 4 losses, it would also prevent him from playing in the Pac-12 title game, which would give him another game in which to to make his case to Heisman voters. So that would be a double blow to Lee's Heisman hopes, and also obviously a big blow to USC. So this game, I'm not really sure what's going to happen. I would give it a 50-50 chance that USC wins, and just as good a chance that UCLA wins. So going on to Oregon Stanford, Stanford is a different team now with Kevin Hogan. They're going to be a bear to handle in the Pac-12 the next few years because of him. He's sort of like another Andrew Luck, I believe, just the same style as when they were both freshmen. Hogan's a sophomore, but when Luck was a freshman, he had the same style as Hogan now. I think that Barner has to have a huge game against Stanford, and it's going to be tough because of that rush defense, but he's got to have a huge game in the 200-yard range, I think, to get back in the Heisman conversation. He kind of he had 65 yards last weekend against Cal, and that kind of, he lost some of the momentum he had from the 321-yard game against USC. Now he needs to get back on that track to get over the 1,800 yards I think he needs to really be a factor in the race.
Ertz was looking very Kobe Fleener-ish once Hogan got under center. That was it is interesting to see the way that he has been able to come in and sort of change around that offense. My thanks to Chris Houston, Mr. Heisman Pundit. Make sure you follow him on Twitter at Heisman Pundit and check out all of the Heisman Watch material at CBSSports.com. He will be in the Rose Bowl for that USC-UCLA game that we mentioned earlier. Chris, thank you so much once again for another Heisman Cast. We are now weeks away from chatting while you are in New York.
Yeah, it's almost time to get that that airline ticket ready. I'm going to be checking out the tickets tomorrow because, they say that Tuesdays are the best day to buy your tickets, so I'm going to be checking that out.
Yeah, that we haven't punched. We think we can punch tickets for some of these candidates, but we know we can punch it for our man, Chris Houston. So my thanks to Chris. Make sure you tune in to all the CBSSports.com podcasts. You can go to iTunes, review, rate, leave a comment. And, of course, if you have a question for a future podcast, feel free to get at me on Twitter, @CNPatterson3. For Chris Houston, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.